BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is the publisher and editor Margaret Busby. Her trailblazing career began when she was just 23 and keen to publish the kinds of books that she and her young friends wanted to read. She co-founded Alison and Busby, the publishing house that still bears her name, and made history as both the youngest person and first black woman to set up her own press. As well as spending 20 years at its helm, she worked as a playwright, journalist and editor. In 1992, she created the landmark anthology Daughters of Africa, pulling together writings by women of African descent from ancient Egypt onwards. Many of today's literary leading lights cite it as a major influence. So when she heard it had gone out of print 25 years later, she decided to do it again, and New Daughters of Africa was published in 2019. The author Zadie Smith describes her as a cheerleader, instigator and celebrator of black arts for the past 50 years, shouting about us from the rooftops, even back when few people cared to listen. She remains an ardent champion of great literature and spent lockdown reading 162 novels as chair of the 2020 Booker Prize jury. She says, "It's astonishing what you can do when you don't care who gets the credit." Margaret Busby, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Thank you very much.
You were chair of last year's Booker Prize jury, which came up with one of the most varied shortlists in the prize's history. 4 of the 6 shortlisted books were by writers of black, Asian and minority ethnic backgrounds. And the winning novel was Douglas Stewart's Shuggie Bain, about a gay working class boy growing up in Glasgow, partly inspired by his own childhood. How was it pulling that shortlist together?
I think you have to give credit to the people who chose the judges, if you like, because it was a very diverse group of judges, if you like. Diverse in terms of the fact that it had people of different ages, people from different areas, different backgrounds, people who were readers, people who were editors, people who were reviewers, people who were writers. So we all came together from different perspectives and we were all looking to agree on what we thought was the best book. But it was wonderful to find that we all did agree on the long list, the short list and the eventual winner.
Judging during a pandemic, how did that work? So all online, all on Zoom, presumably?
It was all on Zoom. I think we had an initial meeting before lockdown, but then we weren't all in the same room then because not all the judges live in Britain. But we just were all doing our best, hour after hour, month after month, to undertake and deliver a verdict that we all agreed with and we all are proud of. And I think we did that.
So disc number one then, if you wouldn't mind, tell us a little bit about your first choice today and why you've chosen it.
Well, the first choice for My Desert Island is 7 Seconds, which is a song that's performed by Youssou N'Dour and Nene Cherry. And I've chosen it because I remember hearing it at a concert that was part of Africa 95, which was an initiative that happened over a season in Britain, around the country. And there was a concert at which Youssou N'Dour was performing, and I was watching him in a group of friends. Everything just seemed right. And this is a song that brings me back to that moment. But apart from that, the words are just so telling and so important. And there's a line I particularly like: when a child is born into this world, it has no concept of the tone the skin is living in. And that's to tell you that everything we know about prejudice and racial discrimination is not born with us. We learn it. And when a child is born,
not a second.
7 seconds, Yusendor with Nana Cherry. So, Margaret Busby, you were born in Ghana in the 1940s. What memories do you have of your earliest days there?
My father was a doctor in what we call the bush, in the rural areas. But occasionally we came up to the capital, Accra, because he had to buy drugs and so on. And in the bush, we had none of the conveniences of modern life. We didn't have running water that came out of the tap when you turned a tap. We didn't have electricity that you had when you put on a switch. We had paraffin lamps to get light.
Margaret, you mentioned that your father was a doctor, and preparing for today, I found a lovely video clip online. You're there in Walthamstow in London paying tribute to him, Dr. George Busby, and unveiling a blue plaque that was put in his honour there for his work as a GP in the 1920s. Tell me more about him and more about that story and his connection to that area.
Well, my father was actually born in Barbados, and his father was a tailor. And when my father was a few weeks old, the family moved to Trinidad. So my father grew up in Trinidad. And his father took him when he was a young boy to show him the premier school in Port of Spain, the capital, which was called Queen's Royal College, and said to my father, if you want to go to this school and get a proper education, you have to be bright and win scholarships. So that's what my father did. He won a scholarship to Queen's Royal College, where he made lifelong friends, including C.L.R. James, who was a
historian.
Became a well-known historian. But my father then won what was called the Island Scholarship, which meant that he could go and study in Britain, which he did in 1919. He left Trinidad. He came to Britain. He studied, first of all, at the University of Edinburgh. Then he went to Dublin, and he qualified as a doctor from Dublin. And he then went to practice as a doctor in Walthamstow in London, in a working class area.
And he was there for 10 years or so.
He was there until 1929, because this was way before the National Health Service. So he told me that there was a barter system, so that the butcher used to pay him in pork chops.
His path must have been very unusual at the time. What did he tell you about his experiences while he was training and in the early days of his career?
He wasn't one to have the spotlight focused on himself, but I remember bits and pieces. Like, for example, he told me when he was in Dublin, a nickname he was given was Burnt Cork, which I guess was a reference to his skin colour.
Wow.
But, that was no big deal. And he went to Ghana, or the Gold Coast as it was then, at a time when there were a handful of other doctors and lawyers and professional people from the West Indies who were, I suppose, part of that Pan-African movement, who became like extended family. They were like my extended family, if you like.
It's time for some more music, Margaret. Tell me about your next disc.
Well, I'd like to take a disc which, to me, reminds me a bit of that Trinidadian heritage, as well as the connection that my father had with C.L.R. James that led to my publishing C.L.R. James. Because C.L.R. James wrote an iconic, a really important book called The Black Jacobins, which was about the Haitian Revolution. And there's a Calypsonian called David Rudder who wrote a very perceptive soca tune called Haiti, I Am Sorry, which was dealing with the legacy of what happened after the Haitian Revolution and the sufferings that Haiti is still subject to up to the present day. And I remember, I don't know whether I imagined this, but I think I remember listening to this song with C.L.R. James, and he made a point of saying, listen to the first two lines, Toussaint was a mighty man, and to make matters worse, he was black. It's talking about Toussaint Louverture, who was behind the Haitian Revolution.
Haiti, David Rudder. So, Margaret Busby, I have to ask you about your mother then, Sarah. She also worked in healthcare, like your father. She left Ghana to train as a midwife in Edinburgh in the 1930s before returning home. That seems like quite an adventurous thing to do back then. She must have been a very dynamic person.
My mother, in the 30s, came to Britain. She came to London. She actually trained at Queen Mary's Hospital for Sick Children in Carshalton in Surrey. And she also trained as a midwife in Scotland. And she, I remember her telling me about the fact that she had to go and deliver children in little villages where they'd never seen any black people before. And she was called Blackie Nurse. She then went back to Ghana and she was a nursing sister at Achimota School. My mother was a practical person. My mother was the person who made sure that she found somehow the money to make sure her children's school fees were paid, even if it meant that she only had one dress that she wore in the day and washed at night and wore the next day. She wanted us to know how to play the piano. In fact, she bought us a piano. My earliest school days were spent trying to learn the piano. In fact, I won a certificate at the Hastings Music Festival.
So your parents worked together in the rural areas surrounding Suhum in Ghana. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit more about their practice. You said no mod cons. Mm. How busy were they?
They were busy. My father went on trek, as they put it, to villages where there were no medical facilities. My father had a dispensary in Suhum. In fact, some of my earliest memories, as my sister was helping in the dispensary, wrapping up ointment and bits of paper or sticking labels on bottles. So there were lots of practical things that had to be done. There were no easy solutions.
It's time for your third disc today, Margaret. What are we going to hear next and why?
Well, I spoke about my mother wanting us to learn to play the piano. And I remember learning a Bach prelude in C, which is something on which the Gounod Ave Maria was based. And so whenever I hear that, I can hear my mother's voice in my head singing along. My mother had a wonderful voice, but she never used it professionally because she was doing her medical work.
Ave Maria by Gounod, sung by Kathleen Battle with the Orchestra of St Luke's, conducted by Leonard Slatkin. Margaret Busby, your parents then sent you and your brother and sister to boarding schools in the UK. So you and your sister Eileen were together. You went to Charters Towers Boarding School for Girls in Bexhill-on-Sea. What were your first impressions of the place? You were very little, I think, when you arrived.
In fact, my mother had trouble finding a school that would take us. And I remember her saying that she would speak to the headmistresses or whoever, and they'd say, well, we don't mind, but it's the parents of the other girls who might mind. But eventually, Charters Towers School in Bexhill-on-Sea took us, and the headmistress was an extraordinary woman called Eileen McGarry, who was really progressive, and it was an international school. And the deputy headmistress was called Margaret Steinitz. And I remember meeting Gary, as she was called, the headmistress, on her 100th birthday, just a few years ago. She died when she was 102. And Gary said, well, although you were so young, I think I was 8, and you were younger than we would normally have allowed a pupil to be to take her on, but because you were Margaret and your sister was Eileen and I was Eileen and our deputy was Margaret, we said, we've got to take them. They're Eileen and Margaret.
So it was fate that brought you there.
I was the youngest in the school and I was holding my own. And, you know, I did find my old school report recently, and it talked about, you know, Margaret's not doing badly sort of thing, but she's a bit untidy in the dormitory. So what's changed? Nothing much. So I was at Charters Towers with some wonderful friends from all over the world, with Eileen as well. Eileen was always by my side, but we had other children from around the world. So I learned to count in Farsi and to swear in Mandarin and things I've never dared try out.
You must have missed home. You must have missed your parents. Obviously, presumably it was very helpful having your sister with you. But what do you remember about the huge change from growing up in Sohome at your parents' medical practice to suddenly being at a boarding school in Bexhill? It must have been another world.
I suppose it was another world. But the thing is, when you're a school child, you don't have anything to compare it with. That's the schooling you had. And we had fun. We had friends. But I realised much later that the one who was actually having the hard time was my mother. Mm. Because I found letters from her. And she would always send us lots of wonderful letters with new Ghana stamps on, first day covers, keeping in touch with us. And I remember reading letters from her that said, "How tall are you now?" Oh. And so I suddenly realised very late that she was the one having a hard time. Mm. She didn't know how tall her children were.
All right, Margaret, let's take a break for some music. This is disc number 4. Why have you chosen it?
Stevie Wonder's Visions. Now, I could really have chosen 8 tracks by Stevie, because Stevie has been such an important figure in my life, in my sister's life, in the life of my family, my friends. And he was somebody who I first met, I suppose, or my sister first met in the 1970s, because we were both doing freelance work for the BBC African Service, and he remained in touch, supportive. And on the day my sister died last year, Stevie sent a message to Andre saying, "Let Eileen hear this." And it was a video of him singing Visions, which he sent to Eileen just an hour before she died.
People hand in hand, have I lived to see the milk in Honeyland? Hates a dream and love forever stands. Or is this a vision in my mind?
Stevie Wonder and Visions. Tell me a little bit more about your further education. I know you studied English at Bedford College, which was part of the University of London. What about your peer group, Margaret, at the time? I mean, on your course, for example, this is London in the very early 60s. Were there many other black students along with you?
No. Right. I can remember, for example, in my year at Bedford reading English, I was the only black woman. It was a woman's college.
It also could be a barrier to finding rental accommodation and things like that. Did you ever have to manage those kinds of situations?
Finding somewhere to rent, finding somewhere to live was a problem. I remember I stayed in all sorts of different places when I was at university. I stayed in a private hotel, and I remember then I couldn't afford to have a sandwich as well as take the bus to my lectures, so I had to choose either or. I remember another time I stayed with an actress who had a spare room for a while. And on another occasion, I had nowhere to stay. And so I went up to Cambridge and I climbed over the wall and stayed with my fiancé. It was all an era of people not wanting to accommodate black people. And so that was happening at the same time as I was trying to get through my course and get a degree. That was the era we were in.
Were you inured to it, or were you angry about it, hurt by it?
I think always in those situations you have to choose which battles you fight. I could have fought a battle every day, all day, but I was focused on what I was doing. I was associating with people who didn't believe that there was anything wrong with being black, so it wasn't something that I had to deal with on a daily, intimate basis. Mm. And what I was doing was more important than worrying about what people thought about me.
Margaret, it's time for your next piece of music. What are we going to hear and why have you chosen it today?
The next track I'd like to hear is Nina Simone singing My Baby Just Cares For Me, because this takes me back to a lot of the records we used to play when I was in those pre-university years, about to hit the real world, sneaking off to parties with my sister and my friend Jan. And Nina Simone was one of those people that we played time and time again on our LPs, and I just continued loving this song, and it's still something that I love, and I'm happy to dance to it still. So let's hear Nina Simone playing My Baby Just Cares For Me.
My baby don't care for shows. My baby don't care for clothes. My baby just cares for me. My baby don't care for cars and races. My baby don't care for high tone places. Liz Taylor is not a star high, and even Lana Turner's smile, something he can't see. My baby don't care, who knows? My baby just cares for me.
Nina Simone and My Baby Just Cares For Me. Now, Margaret Busby, I cannot let you take Nina Simone to the island without you telling us about getting to know her, because I've seen photographic evidence of the two of you hanging out.
We were both in Trinidad, I think, for Carnival. I can't remember what year it was. And we came back to London on the same plane because she had to do some television interview. And we had a meal or two together with her agent and other people. And she was also singing at Ronnie Scott's, and I heard her singing at Ronnie Scott's jazz club. She was at that time, I think, trying to get her autobiography written, and she wanted help from people in different ways. So it was in that era, and we vaguely kept in touch.
Margaret Busby, you were the co-founder of the publisher Alison and Busby in 1967 at just 23, the youngest person to found their own publishing house and the UK's first black female publisher too. How did the business actually get started?
Alison and Busby started from the meeting of Clive Allison and Margaret Busby before we were even graduates. And my friend Rachel Anderson was about to marry a friend of his, and they were having a party to celebrate this, and we were talking about what we were doing at our respective universities, writing poetry, publishing poetry, editing college magazines. And the question was, what are you going to do when you graduate? I thought I might get into publishing. Let's start a publishing house. And so we met up after graduating, and we decided to start by publishing poetry, which we were both interested in, and we found a way to get these books typeset cheaply on the electric typewriter. We produced them.
So they were 5 shillings each, I think.
They were 5 bob each. We didn't know how many copies to print. We printed 5,000 copies each, so we had 15,000 5 bob poetry books, because we wanted to make poetry books cheap enough for young people like us to afford. We had no way of distributing them apart from stopping people in the street or knocking on doors, until we actually eventually got some help from Andre Deutsch, a publisher who helped to distribute our books. Well, we started from the point of knowing nothing about the industry, how many copies you printed, what you did with them when you'd printed them.
So you didn't know the conventions,
we
you could break
none
the rules.
Of the conventions, we break the rules, we could just do what we believed in, and we went on from there. And you have authors you believe in. I was working closely with a lot of different authors, whether there were people like Sam Greene, the first writer we published, or Boucher Machetta, another writer I worked closely with, or Roy Heath, a Guyanese writer, as well as writers who were not black, like Michael Moorcock. And it was a really eclectic list. When I saw that C.L.R. James, my father's friend, who I knew was an important writer, was not in print mostly in Britain, we started republishing C.L.R. James. We started with three volumes of selected writings. We published Black Jacobins, his famous book, which had gone out of print. That was the sort of thing that made it worthwhile. We could do things because we believed in them that other people were not doing because they either didn't know or they had different perspectives on the world.
Yes, and that fed into this reputation for being adventurous and unconventional. I mean, like many listeners, I grew up reading the fantastically successful Worst Witch series by Jill Murphy.
Oh, Jill, yeah, that was a wonderful book. The first we started with The Worst Witch, and she went on to publish The Worst Trick Strikes Again and other books. So there were people who came to us because they knew we were mavericks, if you like.
Margaret, I could talk about the books all day, but we've got to make room for the music too. So it's time for your sixth choice today. Tell us about this one. Why are you taking it with you?
Masanga by Jean Bosco Mwenda, a Congolese guitarist. And this was actually given to me as a 78, as a wedding present in the 60s, and I was mesmerised by it. It's just so intricate. I never tire of hearing it. And I was delighted to find another recording of the tune by John Williams, the guitarist, who became a friend because I published his father, actually. I published a couple of books by John Williams' father, Len Williams. But Masanga is a brilliant guitar performance, if you like, and I recommend it to anybody. Well, just listen to some wonderful music.
Narina mwenda ndia yetu jadovile Ende ya piti ndia yetu ya buluo Ende ya mwambie baba Bosco anakwenda Wende mwambie mtoto yule ya bayeke Winde umwambie mwenye singo ya upanga
Jean Bosco Mwenda and Masanga. Margaret Busby, part of your very significant contribution to the publishing world has been two monumental anthologies. Daughters of Africa came out in 1992 and New Daughters of Africa followed in 2019. In the introduction to the latter, you ask us to feast on its banquet of words, and there really is so much to enjoy. 800 pages embracing authors everywhere from Antigua to Zanzibar and from the present day back to West African poetry of the 1700s. And the writing of abolitionist Sarah Parker Remond. How on earth did you set about deciding what to include?
Well, the first volume, Daughters of Africa, that was, in fact, was easier because I just went to my bookshelves and my boxes and piles of newspapers and magazines and books and selected what I wanted, and that was how it happened. It's just amazing how many wonderful writers haven't had enough attention, haven't had the spotlight shone on them. Not to say that those who have are not worthy of it. This volume contains writers who are well known as well as writers who are not well known. So you may have all the writers you already know who are of African descent, whether you're talking about Chimamanda or Zadie Smith or names that you've heard of. But there are so many other writers who deserve attention. And I could do another volume tomorrow of all the people I left out or who didn't get back to me in time or who I've just learnt about.
It's time to hear your next disc, Margaret, number 7 already. What's next?
There are so many wonderful songs by Miriam McCabe that I've listened to over the decades. Her former husband, Hugh Matakela, wrote Soweto Blues for Miriam McCabe. I was certainly there in the early days of Nelson Mandela being president. And this is something that reminds me both of how far we've come as well as of all the contributions that women have made to music and to the arts, including literature.
The children got a letter from the master. It said no more Xhosa, Sotho, no more Zulu. Comply, they sent an answer. That's when the policeman came to the rescue. The children were flying, bullets dying, all the mothers screaming.
Miriam McCabe and Soweto Blues. Margaret Busby, you've been a pioneer in your field. You've been involved in a number of initiatives looking at the diversity of the publishing industry, both in who's published, but also who is working within the industry. Have you seen enough change during your lifetime?
I think there is so much change that needs to be done still. Of course, there has been change, and I think it's important that you get different people choosing the stories, because you get different people consuming the stories as well. It's not that I only read books by black women. I read books by all sorts of people. And it's not that people who write only write about themselves. I think you have to just look at it in terms of, why would you only eat spinach if you can also eat chocolate? And they're both good for you.
Yeah, in completely different ways. Margaret, it's almost time to cast you away. How good are you with solitude, I wonder?
I don't mind being on my own. I can spend a lot of time in my own head, but I love being with other people. I miss my friends. I miss all the people I haven't seen since lockdown began. I will certainly miss not being able to have a little dance with my partner Luke, not being able to phone up friends, not being able to do all the social things that make life worth living.
One more tune before you go then, Margaret. This is your final choice today. What is it?
Just to reflect something about my love of jazz and my love of dancing. I mean, I'm a trustee of a wonderful organisation, which is now 30 years old this year, called Tomorrow's Warriors, which is a charity which tries to give musical education opportunities to young people who wouldn't otherwise have that opportunity. So that feeling of connecting with jazz is to me, is something joyous, and I'd like to capture that in a track that I often listen to from an album called Sunny Side Up, which features performances by Dizzy Gillespie, Sonny Rollins and Sonny Stitt, and it's On the Sunny Side of the Street.
Sunny Side of the Street, performed by Dizzy Gillespie, Sonny Rollins and Sonny Stitt, and a track that you like to cut a rug to in your daily life, Margaret.
Yeah, well, I was dancing to that just the other day with my partner Luke, and we miss our Friday night dances that we used to go to in a local get-together. But, you know, we had two people parties, and this is a good track for that.
Well, it'll be a solo party on the island, but definitely a good one to have with you. So, Margaret Busby, it's time to cast you away. I'm going to give you three books, the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare. Of course, you can also have a book of your choosing. What will it be?
What I'm going to have is an actual copy of a book that my father was given by C.L.R. James. In fact, it's inscribed for George from Nello, which was CLR's nickname, and it's a copy of Return to My Native Land by Aimé Césaire. There are various wonderful bits that Césaire wrote in that, one of which formed the basis of a volume of selected writings by CLR James that I published called At the Rendezvous of Victory. And that is from a saying that says, "No race holds a monopoly of beauty, of intelligence, of strength, and is a place for all at the rendezvous of victory." So that, to me, gives hope that we're all going to get together and have a good time in the end.
It's yours to take with you. Of course, you can also have a luxury item, something to make your time on the island more enjoyable. What would you like?
I'd like an endless supply of chocolate. Not just any chocolate, made in Ghana chocolate. OK?
Why Ghanaian chocolate in particular? Is that just patriotic?
It's the best chocolate in the world.
OK. Just checking. An endless supply is yours. I wouldn't deny you that. Finally, and perhaps this is the most difficult, which of these discs would you save above the others if you're forced to choose?
Stevie Wonder's Visions, because that reminds me of so many good times, as well as sad times. I think of the fact that my sister died the day before George Floyd died, and Stevie sent her this track.
Margaret Busby, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Hi, I really hope you enjoyed that interview with the publisher and editor Margaret Busby. We've cast away many publishers to the Desert Island, including Carmel Khalil, Kay Webb and Victor Gallant. You can find their episodes in our Desert Island Discs programme archive and through BBC Sounds. Next time, my guest will be the fashion designer Paul Costello. I do hope you'll join us.
Hi, I'm Matthew Side, and I'd like to invite you to see the world differently with my podcast, Sideways.
Those societies and social networks begin to act as a brain, a collective brain unto itself.
Sideways is all about the ideas that shape our lives. And in this series, I'll get to grips with the myth of mind control.
This is your subliminal programming tape on smoking control.
He's what I would consider to be a quack, a charlatan.
And I'll find out why it's so hard to be original. For all this and more, subscribe to Sideways on BBC Sounds.